Hello and welcome. My name is Mark Byatt, Director of Communications for the IFRS Foundation. I'm here today with Alan Teixeira, Director of Technical Activities, and Steve Cooper, member of the IASB. Hello, guys.
Hi.
So this is a summary of the IASB board meeting held on the week commencing the 19th of September 2011. Let's go straight in. Steve, perhaps you could begin by talking about the discussions related to financial instruments.
Okay, thanks, Mark. There are three areas of financial instruments that we discussed at this meeting: offsetting, impairment, and hedge accounting. Let me start off with impairment. This is the continuing discussions on the latest thinking that we have on impairment, the so-called three-bucket approach. The board's continued to make some progress on this, but we certainly didn't reach any final conclusions. I think it's important to emphasize that the board's been looking at this for some time. The board particularly wanted to try and focus on a relative approach, a deterioration approach in terms of credit, and we're looking at ways in which we can make that operational. And I think what we've come to is that tracking problems in terms of looking at how credit changes are a particular difficulty, and therefore we're exploring what is an absolute approach in terms of what goes into the three buckets, but in a way that hopefully reflects some of the thinking that we had in terms of relative changes. Still very much work in progress. We asked the staff to go back and look at two issues in particular. One is how to deal with purchased loans, including those purchased in a business combination, and also how to deal with loans which are originated into one of the lower credit risk categories, particularly loans originated into Bucket 2. These are two of the important issues that would arise if we were to go down an absolute approach in that area. So more work to do in terms of impairment. For offsetting, you recall this is where we have where we've got to is to look at firstly the disclosures, but also tidying up some aspects of IAS 32. So I think, Alan, we've essentially reached the end of the deliberations on that and talked about effective date and transition.
Yeah, we certainly have. We've basically concluded the discussions that we on the offsetting, and with the boards are asked to have a look back and make sure that they were satisfied that we could actually move ahead to a standard, and that included considering whether re-exposure was required. But essentially the board was quite comfortable that what we've considered in our normal exposure process, what we learned through the comment letters we've received and the additional outreach that we've undertaken, that they're comfortable that we should go ahead.
Yeah, and the clarifications that we're doing to IAS 32 are through adding in application guidance to IAS 32 rather than changing the standard itself.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, and the third area that we looked at was hedge accounting. Talked about a number of different aspects here. Let me just pick on a couple of the important ones. This was really the end of our deliberations in terms of the basic hedge accounting model. So we discussed transition, for example, and concluded that a prospective application of the hedge accounting model would be appropriate with some limited exceptions and one or two areas where some retrospective application could be applied. That was in particular in terms of the changes in respect of options. The other main area that we discussed that we had to finalise was hedges of credit risk using credit derivatives. We discussed this on a number of occasions. We asked the staff last time to look at three different approaches: an insurance approach, a sort of imputed risk component approach, and the methodology that we had actually put into the first ED in the basis, where we were describing a fair value through profit and loss approach, an elective fair value through profit and loss approach. We discussed each of these. Came to the conclusion that neither the insurance approach nor the imputed risk component approach would really work very well, and concluded that we should go with the fair value through profit and loss, method two of the three methods that were described in the basis. And I think we had some good support for that approach. It's by no means a perfect solution to the problems of credit risk, and it's one of the areas that we've struggled with all the way through. But I think it certainly will improve the accounting in that area. So anyway, that's the methodology that we decided on. And I think, again, that's about it in terms of wrapping up the basic hedging model. And Alan, where are we going from here?
Well, the board had a look and decided that we don't need to re-expose this. But what we are going to do is have what I guess we call an extended fatal flaw review. The intention now is to develop a draft of the final requirements, and that includes any associated application guidance, a full basis for conclusions, and make those available publicly on our website. We do that for at least 90 days or thereabouts, and that's going to give the board a couple of opportunities to do some things. One is to undertake, as I said, an extended fatal flaw review. That means we can go out and with the document as it is and make sure that people are comfortable with the wording. The other thing is it also gives the USFASB a chance to have a look at what those requirements are, because they're certainly not as advanced in terms of the developments of a hedging model. So it just gives us a chance to pause before we go ahead to finalise this. But as I said, it's not a formal re-exposure. It's just to help us in terms of the final drafting.
Okay. The other thing I ought to mention on hedging is that we continued our deliberations, our discussions on the macro hedging model. We didn't make any decisions. It was mainly of an educational session, but the work on that is very much continuing.
Okay. Alan, perhaps you could talk a little bit about the work in advance of the leases re-exposure.
Sure. Well, as you quite rightly said just then, it's the re-exposure. We decided in July that we would go ahead and re-expose the leases proposals. We focused mainly on lessor accounting this time. One of the things we had a look at was the application of financial asset guidance to the right to receive lease payments, because there are questions about how you measure those. Are they financial assets or are they some sort of other type of asset? What sort of impairment test do you have, for example? Essentially, the board's made a few tentative decisions. One was that the lessor should measure the right to receive lease payments using the effective interest method. Secondly, the lessor should refer to the existing financial instruments guidance. So for us at the ISB, that's IS 39, and it's topic 1.310 that is in the US, and dealing with impairment. So we look to our financial instruments guidance there. And the other one is that we decided we shouldn't have an option for fair value measurement of the right to receive lease payments. But they are going to have a little look to see what happens if perhaps you've got situations where your business is to originate with a view to selling the selling those leases or lease receivables. And we had also had a look at some other measurement issues. For example, the board's decided that a lessor should recognise in profit and loss immediately any changes in the right to receive lease payments due to reassessments of variable lease payments. That depend on an index or a rate. It was unanimously agreed by our board. And our board decided that the revaluation of the residual asset should be prohibited. So some issues around about that. We also had a look at residual value guarantees. And the boards both decided that the leases standard should provide guidance on accounting for residual value guarantees, regardless of whether they're provided by the lessee, a third party, or another or a related party. The other thing is a lessor would not recognise amounts that they expect to receive under residual value guarantee until the end of the lease. But you still have to consider those guarantees when you're working out whether the residual asset's impaired. So, you know, we're getting towards the end of this. The nice thing is on the project, once again, we have a consistent agreement across the board with the lease accounting. Both in lessor and lessee, the FASB and ISB have reached the same conclusions. We had another look at some disclosure issues as well. I think for lessor, it's probably important as well. The boards have decided is that in presenting in the statement of financial position, the lessor would present the lease receivable and the residual asset separately, either on the face or you put a total amount of leased assets on the face or on the balance sheet, and then you put the breakdown in the notes, and either would be acceptable.
Okay. Another joint project, although not part of the MOU, is insurance. Steve, could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we had two topics, disclosures and then the risk adjustment. On disclosures, it was reconfirming a lot of the things that we've already got in the ED, but one deletion and one important insertion, I guess. Deletion is to delete the requirement that an insurer should not aggregate information relating to different reportable segments. This was a feeling that perhaps we'd overdone it in terms of disaggregation by requiring it both by product type and the like, but also by segment. And it was feeling that that was inappropriate, and the board agreed with that. The addition is to require the disclosure of a yield curve for the discount rate applied to non-participating contracts. This came out of our discussions on discount rate, long, lengthy discussions that we had on that. And I think it was important, people felt that we had a very clear disclosure of what discount rate was chosen, given the subjectivity in that area. In terms of the risk adjustment, we made some minor tweaks to the definition of a risk adjustment and came up with, I think, a much clearer explanation as to exactly what that is. We decided that we wouldn't limit the range of techniques available. Recall in the exposure draft, we had specified three alternative techniques that could be applied. However, we will retain within the application guidance the list of characteristics that we specified in terms of what a risk adjustment should portray and how it would be higher in some circumstances, lower in other circumstances. Perhaps the controversial bit of the decisions this time was in terms of one of the disclosures related to risk adjustment. We had proposed that in order to try and give a basis for comparing different companies and the way they calculate a risk adjustment, that we would set a disclosure of the confidence level equivalent of a particular risk adjustment. So however a company calculated it, whatever model they used, they would have to tell, say, what the implied confidence level was. And this proved quite a controversial area within the exposure draft. The board spends a good bit of time discussing this, not just here, but also in previous meetings and other forums, and concluded that we should retain that confidence level risk adjustment. I think the board felt it was a very important element of the disclosure package to give transparency and comparability to an area which is clearly quite subjective.
Thank you. Alan, any other topics that were discussed during the meeting?
Well, we actually had close to half a day on a bit of a catch-up on some issues that have been discussed through our interpretations and implementation processes. We looked at quite a few annual improvements, and there's a list of about seven or eight items that had been recommended for inclusion. So we'll discuss those. Again, it'd be easy to wait, I think, for ISB update to go through the detail there. We also had a look at an interesting issue on non-controlling interest puts. And so what this is when you've got non-controlling interests and there's a put on those. So it's an issue that has been discussed six times, I believe, by the Interpretations Committee. They did quite a bit of work for the board and had a recommendation on how we could make a what they consider to be a narrow scope change to IS 32, dealing with us making an exception. The board is a bit concerned about what the implications of that, whether we're starting to open the door and cause problems downstream for some other related instruments. So the board's actually, is quite sympathetic to doing something with this, but is going to ask the Interpretations Committee if they'd like to take a slightly different approach to it. So that's been sent back down to them. The two other issues that we had a look at, I guess one's important because it'll be a forthcoming publication. The board did approve what will become IFRIC 20, which is stripping costs in the production phase of a surface mine. This is involved when you're digging up basically in an open mine, for example, and you're digging away the non-ore, so cleaning up and how you account for those. So IFRIC 20 has been approved and will be out in the next few weeks or so. The other item was of interest was we've been asked by ESMA, which is the European Securities Markets Authority, essentially to have a look at an issue related to segment reporting. And I think the board, again, is sympathetic to trying to make sure that we get consistent application of IFRS 8, which is a segment reporting standard. ESMA has come to us and has identified a problem in relation to how segments are actually determined. We're going to go back and have a look to see if there's some way that we can actually help either whether it's necessary to make an amendment to IFRS 8 or whether we can do something through education to try and resolve that issue. So we'll have a look at that as well.
And recent documents published?
Since the last board meeting, we've published an exposure draft on investment entities. This is a proposal to introduce a scope exclusion for what we call investment entities. So these are things like investment funds and the sort of entities that that essentially groom up other entities, where they're mainly focused on fair value in terms of their assessment. So it's a fairly, we hope, carefully defined group of entities. But essentially this is, as I said, a scope exclusion from IFRS 10, which is our consolidation standard. It's out for 3 months of exposure, so I encourage people to have a look at that. And of course, although I think we mentioned it last time, the agenda consultation is still in process. We're expecting feedback by the end of the year.
Great, thank you. And a busy time in October with conferences coming up.
We have conferences both in the North and South America in Boston in a few weeks. In fact, next week, I believe. And then a couple of weeks after that, we go off to South America for a conference. Our trustees are meeting in Paris in just under 3 weeks. And we also have Standards Advisory Council, the IFRS Advisory Council, is meeting here in London in just under 3 weeks as well.
Busy times. So thank you to Alan and to Steve. That just leaves me to provide the obligatory health warning that these are the personal views of the presenters and do not necessarily represent those of the IASB. The only official summary of the board meeting is provided by IASB Update, which will be available on the IASB website shortly. Thank you.